Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston C.A. On May 17, 1954, the Supreme Court rendered its historic Brown v. Board of Education decision, which effectively outlawed racial segregation in American schools. With that achievement, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, entered the consciousness of millions of Americans coast to coast. It would remain there for the duration of the era we now call the Civil Rights Revolution. Recognition of the extraordinary legal struggle mounted by the NAACP in advancing the cause of desegregation in America is right and proper. Yet it is just as important to recognize that this effort was rooted in a preceding half-century of struggle and strategy that influenced and reflected an evolving American social history. My guest is Patricia Sullivan, research associate at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. Patricia, welcome to Dialogue.
Pleasure to be here, George.
It's delightful to have you here, and this is a subject that I find particularly compelling, so thank you. You know, we begin, in a sense, Patricia, with a paradox. The NAACP is certainly the largest, certainly the best-known civil rights organization in America, but as an organization, it's probably the least studied, which is a situation I think you hope to help rectify. And as you do that, Patricia, what contribution do you think your work will be making to our understanding of American history in the 20th century? What's the larger importance of knowing the background and history of this organization?
Well, I think one of the main contributions I hope that this work will make builds on scholarship that has been written over the past couple of decades, where we're working to broaden the historical context for understanding the civil rights movement. I mean, that it wasn't something that just arrived on the scene. I mean, as you pointed out in your comments, the Brown decision is a pivotal point in the struggle for civil rights, but it's a piece of a larger history that really encompasses the entire century. And the NAACP is a wonderful way to get at that larger history and its complexities and depth.
Well, that's a very helpful answer, because just from reading some of the things you've written and some of the presentation and hearing some of the presentations you've made, I understand that this complexity begins right at the beginning. That, for example, the organization was, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was founded by white progressives, and at the turn of the century. And then, and this is intriguing to me, very quickly, W.E.B. Du Bois himself became a party to this. And in doing so, he brought a new theme or trend into this, the Niagara Movement of 1905, mm-hmm. which was a more activist African-American organization. What does that blend at the beginning represent, Patricia? I mean, that sounds to me like an extraordinary melding of activists.
Yes, no, I mean, you're so right in describing the founding as such a complicated and in some ways seemingly, you know, contradictory, but it really encapsulates the problems of race in America. And these white progressives were extraordinary leaders for their time. Mm-hmm. And as progressives, they were quite extraordinary, because the progressive movement largely either ignored the issue of race, or in the South was part of implementing right. the laws that would establish Jim Crow. Du Bois was among this small group, as you noted, from the beginning, and he came from another stream, from the Niagara Movement, which he and a number of black men had founded several years before the NAACP to address, really as a counterpoint to Booker T. Washington,
exactly.
who had advocated accommodation and really not pressing on the civil rights front. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, whites initiated this call for a meeting to address issues of racial violence in the North. Du Bois and a number of black leaders responded, like Ida B. Wells and others. And then they began to carve out an organizational way mm-hmm. of starting to deal with these issues.
From its start, and I guess it's 1908 that it formally, or 1909, right after the Springfield riots
yes.
of 1908 that it begins. But from that point, throughout the decades of American history, I got the impression the NAACP was, to use my phrase, always fighting the battle of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, again, one of the things I think your history will bring to the fore, and I'd love to hear you comment on this, was the extraordinary, and I can't emphasize that enough, violence of the first decades racially. Mm-hmm. I mean, lynching and all. So its crucible was really to, in that era, wasn't it? I mean, and that, yes. Those were the first fights it had to take on.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, going back and revisiting this history myself and carving out my study, I mean, the racial, the lynching, I mean, the current exhibit in New York of lynching postcards, which has brought national attention to this crime of, I mean, this extraordinary reality that this country lived with and tolerated for so long. I mean, 60 lynchings a year. And when we say 60, I mean, each one is this sort of ritual torture. And I mean, just to think about that and what that represented in terms of the lawlessness in the South and the risks that African-American people took in standing up to that system. And I think, and then the race riots, Atlanta, Wilmington, Springfield, as you mentioned, in 1908, which happened in the home of Abraham Lincoln, and that really set off alarm bells for northern white progressives. So it's, you know, how do you survive that? And then how do you mount a movement that where you struggle forward? And it's, you know, to be aware of the reality that was America during this period for black people is so important to then understanding what the NAACP was up against and the kinds of tactics and strategies that they began to employ.
Exactly.
And as you point out, change as time goes on and as the nature of the problem changes.
Dozens of people are killed in these things, but doesn't this, and it happened all over the country, I mean, no region was exempt, but clearly there was definitely a concentration in the South. Now, does that fact, the fact that there's certainly a profound Southern dimension to civil rights struggle in America, how does that influence the NAACP in its early years? Does that make them rethink their strategy about where they're going to be and what they're going to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, again, one of the very interesting points that the organization struggled with in its first decade. I mean, initially, they shied away from the South for the reasons we've just discussed. I mean, the violence, I mean, you know, I guess feeling, anticipating that it would be dangerous to try and establish branches there, and for other reasons as well. So what you had was a group of, you know, dominated by northern white progressives struggling around civil rights to help people in the South. Mm-hmm. And it's Du Bois, I mean, immediately through the Crisis magazine, his magazine is really targeted to a black audience, and people are reading it in Mississippi, and they're getting letters, and people are interested in starting branches. And then in end of 1916, James Weldon Johnson, the great author, diplomat, lawyer, I mean, the multi-talented, extraordinary individual, joins the NAACP as its first full-time field secretary. And James Weldon Johnson makes a commitment to bring the association South. And of course, he joins the association, I mean, he had been a member prior to becoming field secretary, just at the moment when we're gearing up for World War I. And that unleashes all kinds of changes that I think broaden the possibilities for civil rights struggles. And then you see, during the war years, I mean, the NAACP presence increases in the South dramatically, where you have membership in the South surpassing membership in the rest of the country. And that really begins to provide the foundation for what we come to know as the civil rights movement.
What does 1930 represent for the? We know what it represents for the country, the Depression, and eventually the advent of FDR.
Mm-hmm.
But let me try to rephrase that question, Patricia, if I can make it a bit more precise, because we think today, you know, looking back, I think appropriately, of the NAACP as an organization with a broad base, you know, present everywhere, very activist, and particularly, and I think if you ask people on the street, they would associate it immediately with legal challenge.
Yes.
Now, are these the kinds of trends that get codified in the 30s? Or, well, what does the 30s represent?
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned 1930, and August Meyer and Elliot Rudwick have sort of say by 1930, this major transition had been completed, mm-hmm. of the NAACP becoming a black-led organization with a mass black membership base. And in the early 30s, Charles Hamilton Houston, who's an extraordinarily important figure, he was at Howard Law School at that time. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School, and really believed that black lawyers had to play a pivotal role in really pushing for the enforcement of the Reconstruction Amendments. And Houston begins working with the NAACP, and in I think it's 1934, becomes the legal director of the NAACP. And his vision, along with work that had been happening within the organization, contributes to the mounting. I mean, there was always litigation, as you point out. I mean, from the beginning, the NAACP looked at the courts as a way to enforce the law. But with Houston and in the 1930s, a campaign was orchestrated, a sustained campaign focusing around the issue of education, to build a legal challenge against the system that existed and for equalizing and ultimately integrating public education in this country. And it begins in the 30s. You know, we open with a discussion of Brown. I mean, this is the beginning of the legal struggle that will culminate with the Brown decision in 1954. But Houston's brilliance and his young associate, Thurgood Marshall, who had been his student, was that, you know, you had to have brilliant constitutional lawyers, and they were two of the best in the country. But you also had to root this legal challenge in community struggle.
Right.
The community had to be with you because they would provide the plaintiffs. They were the people who would have to insist that the law be enforced once it was changed. So all of this comes together in the 1930s in a very powerful way that is directly tied into what unfolds in the 50s and 60s.
That importance of community to the legal challenges that you just mentioned, of course, is a reflection of the importance of building branches.
Yes.
Right? And proselytizing and getting,
yes,
getting the organization widespread, isn't it? Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Patricia Sullivan, Research Associate at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. Patricia, before we go into further decades in the history of the NAACP, I want to ask you kind of a gathering together type question, because it seems to me that what you've been explaining to us in these succession of decades, and particularly the one we've just discussed, amounts to this, that over a period of decades, the NAACP was essentially building up a massive foundation for the civil rights revolution. That, if you wanted to put it perhaps in a sentence, you would say that in many different ways, and particularly with this legal strategy developing, that's what they were doing. They were building up the enormous base that would eventually make all these other things happen.
Yes. Oh, that's foundation is, the perfect word for describing what was happening. And you know, this is hard work, right, in communities on a daily basis. And just, you know, going out to the polls, getting people involved, coming to meetings. And I think Herbert Hill, who was the labor secretary of the NAACP, once said, think of the NAACP as two organizations, a national office and then branches. And there were people like Charles Houston and Ella Baker. I mean, the presence of the national office, the sense of connection. If you're in Alabama working for civil rights in a very dangerous situation under very challenging circumstances, you have a connection to a national office. Lawyers come through, Thurgood Marshall. You know, you're not isolated. It's not you alone against the state of Alabama. It's you as part of a national organization with legal support,
right,
with publicity, with presence and access in Washington.
Some of the letters that you quote in your scholarship where people were in those communities writing the NAACP, you're really poignant, and the with a kind of very earthy eloquence to them about, you know, how, and you get the sense that we were alone until we heard of you, and can you help us with this?
Mm-hmm.
And over again, that would be repeated. That, and I guess the message was, you're no longer alone.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, that's right.
I want to ask you about an aspect of the NAACP's history that may not be as glowing. And I'm from Buffalo, and I understand that a woman from Buffalo was very instrumental in the building of branches.
Yes.
And throughout the South.
Mary Talbert.
Mm-hmm. Mary Talbert. Which leads to the question of the NAACP and women,
mm-hmm,
and what women did for the NAACP and what the organization did or did not do for women.
Good question. And I think very good question, because that's, I mean, you know, we're very interested in that. I mean, as scholars and, you know, and this sense, again, how we think of the civil rights movement, those of us who lived through the 60s, you know, the symbols are men. Mm-hmm. I mean, Martin Luther King, Roy Wilkins, you know, it's who television kind of, well, Fannie Lou Hamer, the powerful image, and she broke through into the national consciousness. But again, I think in thinking of the NAACP as a mass-based organization, when you start to look beyond the national stories and the events and people captured by television and look in local communities, NAACP branches often women, well, often well, women played critical roles in organizing them and leadership roles, you know, in every community. So now the relationships, the power relationships are interesting, and you need to, you know, in my work, I will look closely at that. But I think that once you, again, broaden the context and look in the communities, women are leading in critical ways. And I think this kind of history brings that to the fore. I mean, Rosa Parks was right. Secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery, Alabama, worked very closely with E.D. Nixon. I mean, they had a very good working relationship. And so that's a name. Daisy Bates, Little Rock, Arkansas, tremendous leader in that community, NAACP leader, who was really the mentor to those nine students who integrated Central High. So it's I think at the national, there were conflicts. I mean, Ella Baker resigned in the 1940s because she felt that she just could not do what she needed to do, and she had difficulty working with Walter White. But I think even when we look at that, we need to look at personalities and personal conflicts as well as how gender relationships played out in those contexts as well.
But that again is a complex story, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah. It's an important and complex. Yeah.
Just the names that you have mentioned in that answer, though, I mean, each one is iconic. I mean, you think of Ella Baker, Daisy Bates, Rosa Parks, an American hero now.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
In the years, I'm going to take a slight leap in history here, because after the Civil Rights Revolution, and I keep using that phrase to characterize 54 to 68, and I think the organization was 400,000 strong in those years. It was massive. And as you pointed out, it was basic to the organization. Now, well, let me ask you this question, though. It just occurred to me, Patricia. Massive as it was in those years, and with its role as providing the base, it was also, of course, I wouldn't say competing, but existing with other civil rights organizations, some of them with different approaches, of course, that had sprung up in the 60s. How did that work out? I mean, was that an era of cooperation, conflict?
That's a lot of competition. You know, I mean, civil rights organizations depended on, you know, they needed resources and to litigate cases, to do the work they did. And I think as I go forward in this history, that will be an interesting story to untangle. But I think, you know, the national leadership of the NAACP, people like Roy Wilkins, you know, felt sort of maybe somewhat threatened by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I mean, you know, these are the new kids on the block. Right. We've been here since the beginning. And to be in competition with those groups for, again, television is playing a very important role in sort of identifying leaders during this period. So, but August Meyer and John Bracey have argued that this competition was positive. You know, I mean, that it was and conflict, because everyone had their work to do. I mean, the NAACP was still critical in the legal arena. By the 50s and 60s, it had a very strong presence in Washington. Clarence Mitchell was their, you know, full-time lobbyist on Capitol Hill, working very hard to craft the civil rights legislation. So there's tons of work to do, and I think all of these organizations played critical roles, but you know, people are people, and who's in charge, you know, who gets the credit. It's so that went on. But I think in the end, I don't think it was destructive. I mean, I think it was a positive tension. But I think one of the other reasons that these Southern organizations, SCLC, which Martin Luther King founded, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was created in 1960, I mean, with the Brown decision, Southern states targeted the NAACP for elimination. I mean, massive resistance is what it's called. And, you know, in Alabama, the organization was really outlawed for 10 years. So these other organizations sprang up as a way that people could organize, because the NAACP, I mean, it sounds odd now. I mean, people think of it as a sort of, you know, moderate. The NAACP was in the South considered the most radical, and it was. I mean, it was subversive to the established order of race relations. I mean, Brown was the sign that it was over. Right. And so that was another reason that other organizations sort of came to the fore and were able to provide structures for people to continue this struggle.
So we get various themes of competition and complementarity.
Exactly.
Throughout that period.
Yes, yeah.
Later years, Patricia, seem more troubled in different ways, don't they? I mean, they're now thinking of, well, not quite sure when all this happens, but maybe the 70s or the 80s, at least, when the organization's star perhaps begins to lose a bit of its luster, and there is there's trouble in terms of leadership and image and all the rest, and maybe the word adrift could be used, at least for a portion of this cycle. Is that too much?
No, I mean, I think adrift, and you know what that, I mean, again, what is so interesting about doing this work is being able to kind of look more closely at how things play out. And again, citing August Meyer and John Bracey, they used the term crisis of victory. You know, that when the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were enacted, and the NAACP was pivotal in securing and shaping that legislation, in some ways you could say it was over. You know, that the law was finally in place to protect the rights. I mean, the law, the Civil Rights Act, allowed for the enforcement of Brown, which had been pretty much, you know, difficult to implement since 54. So, but I have, and I think there's some truth to that. And then the Voting Rights Act. I mean, here you had, for nearly 50 years, NAACP was the organization. There was nothing quite like it. Then as voting opens up, and, you know, we have black women and men elected to Congress, the Black Caucus emerges, many other venues for people to struggle to get access, to have their rights protected, to define what they are. So, I mean, it's more than even competition. There's tremendous, it's a whole new playing field. But on the other hand, with the end of legalized segregation in the South, I mean, 5 days after the Voting Rights Act is signed, Watts explodes, and people are, oh my, there are problems in the North, and of a whole different scale. So I think that crisis of victory on the legislative front, I mean, victory there certainly was, and an important victory, but once that was achieved, the nature of the problems around poverty, around the kinds of discrimination and exclusion that black people experienced in northern cities, police brutality, continuing problem. So there was still a lot of work to be done. What happens organizationally with the NAACP is a big question mark for me, because we do know through the media, I mean, the problems, the leadership problems and all, and I think that's something I want to definitely look at more closely and understand. But I do know through my friend Julian Bond, who is now chairman of the NAACP, that branches are still active. That, and again, it's back to that two separate organizations, right, that the NAACP locally in many communities is still the organization that people participate in and turn to when there's a problem, when they're a target of police harassment, when they are unable to purchase a home. You know, school desegregation in the North plays out through NAACP chapters in Boston and other places. But it's, you know, it's the part of the history of the organization that I'm least familiar with as a historian. I mean, I think as someone who's read the press, I mean, we know the, you know, what sort of played out in that arena. But I do think that Kwasi Mfume, as the chief officer of the NAACP, and Julian Bond as chairman, and prior to his chairmanship, Merrily Evers, have really in the national arena given a positive turn and are providing the kind of leadership that has brought the NAACP back into, I think, an important national presence.
Well, I think in point of fact, membership is up, and I think the financial coffers have been somewhat replenished, and those are obviously positive signs. And actually, this part of our conversation really does establish a wonderful base for my concluding question, which is kind of speculative, because we began at the turn of the century with the history of this organization, and we've kind of, with your help, charted its progress through the 20th century, and of course now we're in the 21st. And it's the question of challenges, institutions that don't get new challenges or redefine themselves sometimes have a hard time surviving. And I guess that does hone the question, Patricia. What might those challenges be? I mean, you've just mentioned how the organization discovered that passage of legislation did not eliminate the problems of Black Americans throughout mm-hmm. the country. And as we sit here, we know that issues such as class are getting attention in America now. The so-called technical divide or whatever it is with, yes. with the internet not being able to. And then, of course, there's this overwhelming fact of immigration. Mm-hmm. Many of them people of color from different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Does this mix in your mind, even you know, speculatively, suggest a new set of challenges that the organization may find itself turning to?
Definitely. You know, I think, I mean, you pointed out earlier that there was always a crisis that the NAACP kind of was responding to, and that was such a key to its vitality, its ability to respond creatively and strategically. And I think in terms of the future of the organization, in thinking about the past, I think that there are these new challenges. There are always new challenges. The extent to which a national organization can tie in to local communities, because that's where the challenges are defined, people are living them, are defining them, and civil rights as a national issue is still a national issue, but it's a national issue that only has resonance where people live. And I think the issue of class, I think Dr. Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Campaign, I mean, he raised a challenge then when he went to Chicago and before his death that is still very much with us. And it's not, you know, civil rights is not glamorous. I mean, we think of it as glamorous, the struggle, but it's day to day. It's continuous. It's struggle, the term that you identified earlier. And so I think that that's where we need to look to, and that organizations that are able to survive and thrive will be organizations that are able to live in the present and move to the future.
Well, Patricia Sullivan, I want to thank you not only for the conversation, but for the work you're doing. And I think you helped us all understand something better today, and I think your future work is going to be immensely important to everything that we hope to see happen. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
It was mine. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Patricia Sullivan. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at RadioDial. That's RadioDial at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.